"I'm all right," Hal said, though it was not really the truth. Those two typewritten sheets of paper on the coffee table at home were giving her a sick feeling in the pit of her stomach, and she was half afraid of finding another envelope when she opened up the booth this morning. If only Mr. Trezick's letter had been really meant for her. The urn was up to temperature now, and she watched Reg as he expertly manipulated the spigot and mug with one hand while flipping the bacon with the other. Somehow, talking to the back of his head felt easier than addressing his face. She did not have to see the concern in his eyes. "Actually," she said, and then swallowed, and forced herself on. But the words, when they came, were not the ones she had been intending to say. "Actually, I might be better than all right. I got a letter last night telling me I might be heir to a secret fortune."
"You what?"
Reg turned, mug in his hand, open astonishment in his face.
"What did you say?"
"I got a letter last night from a solicitor, saying I might be due a substantial bequest."
"You winding me up?"
Reg said, his eyebrows almost up to his non-existent hairline. Hal shook her head, and seeing that she was serious, Reg echoed her shake of the head and handed the tea across.
"You be careful, love. There's a lot of these scammers about. My trouble got one the other day, telling her she won the Venezuelan lottery or some nonsense. Don't you be handing over no money. Not that I need to tell you that."
He gave her a wink.
"No flies on you."
"I don't think it's a scam," Hal said, honestly. "More like a mistake, if anything. I think they might have got me mixed up with someone else."
"You think it's one of these air hunter things, where someone's died and they're trying to track down the long-lost relies?"
He was frowning again, but it was not with worry now. More as if considering a conundrum. "Maybe," Hal said. She gave a shrug and sipped cautiously at the scalding tea. It was hot and bitter, but good. The cold, clammy thought of the notes on the coffee table was starting to recede, and she felt a flicker of some old memory stir inside her. The sensation of what it had been like to wake in the morning and not worry about every bill. Not think about where the next rent payment would come from, or worry about the knock on the door. God, what she wouldn't give to get that security back again. She felt something harden inside her, a kind of steely resolve.
"Well,"
Reg said at last,
"if anyone deserves a break, it's you, my darling. You take any money they offer you and run. That's my advice. Take the money and run."
Chapter 6. "Goodbye," Hal said, as the three tipsy girls rolled out of the door, shrieking and laughing down the pier towards the bars and clubs. "May fortune favour you," she added, as she always did, but they were already gone out of earshot. Glancing at her watch, she realised it was 9 p.m. and the pier would be closing soon. She was tired, exhausted in fact, and earlier that evening, as the time stretched on and the pier had stayed empty of visitors, she had thought about giving up, switching the sign off and going home. But she was glad she had stayed. After almost no clients all day, there had been a mini rush at 7 p.m. Two co-workers had come in to ask what they should do about a bullying boss, and then the three drunk girls looking for a laugh at 8 o'clock. She hadn't made a lot, but with luck she would cover the rent on the kiosk this week, which was more than she could guarantee in the off-season. With a sigh, she turned off the little space heater at her feet and stood, ready to switch off the little illuminated sign outside her kiosk. "Madame Margarita," it read in flowing ornate letters. And though the description didn't really suit Hal, conjuring as it did some kind of Gypsy Rose Lee figure, she had not had the heart to change it. specialist in tarot, psychic readings, and palmistry, said the smaller letters below. Although in truth, Hal didn't really enjoy reading palms. Perhaps it was the physical contact, the warm dampness of the sweaty palm in hers. Or perhaps it was the lack of props. Because in spite of her scepticism, she loved the tarot cards as physical objects, the finely drawn images, their soft fragility. Now, though, as she flicked the switch in her booth and the light clicked off outside, there was a rap at the glass. Her stomach flipped, and for a moment she froze, even her breathing stilled.
"I've been waiting," said a hectoring female voice. "Don't you want customers?"
Hal sighed, feeling her tension drain away, and she opened the door. "I'm sorry." She used the calm, professional voice that somehow became part of her persona the moment she picked up the cards. It was halfway between serene and serious, and a tone deeper than her own, though it was harder to conjure the usual, with her heart still thumping in the aftermath of the sudden rush of fear. "You should have knocked earlier."
"If you was a real psychic, you would have known," said the woman with a sour triumph, and Hal suppressed another sigh.
She was going to be one of those. It always baffled Hal why skeptics were so drawn to her booth. It wasn't like she was forcing anyone to come. She wasn't making any claims for her services. She didn't pretend to cure anything or advise dangerous courses of action. She didn't even say that her readings were anything other than a bit of fun. Weren't there better people to debunk? And yet they came and folded their arms and pursed their lips and refused to be led and looked grimly delighted at every failure, even while they wanted desperately to believe. But she couldn't afford to turn a customer away. "Please come in and sit down. It's a cold night," Hal said. The woman drew up a chair but didn't speak. She only sat, her herringbone coat drawn firmly around herself, chapped lips clamped together, eyes narrowed. Hal settled herself at the table, drew the box of tarot cards towards her, and began to run through the practiced introduction she always used when new clients walked in off the street. A few generalized guesses designed to impress the listener with her insight, a sprinkling of braggadocio, all mixed in with a potted history of tarot, aimed at people who knew little about it and needed a context to understand what she was about to do. She had only run through a few of the phrases when the woman interrupted.
"You don't look like much of a psychic."
She looked Hal up and down, taking in the frayed jeans, the thick gauge earring shaped like a thorn through her right ear, the tattoos peeping out from beneath her T-shirt.
"I thought you'd have a costume and a veil with dangly bits, like a proper one. Madame Margarita, it says on the sign. You don't look like much of a madame, more like a 12-year-old boy."
Hal only smiled and shook her head. But the words had broken her rhythm, and as she resumed her little speech, she found herself thinking of the veil at home in the drawer under the bed. The fine black gauze, with the jet drops sewn around the edge. She stumbled over the well-worn phrases, and was glad when she reached the end of the spiel. At last she finished and added, as she always did, "Please tell me what brings you to consult the cards today."
"Shouldn't you know that?"
the woman snapped. "I sense many questions in you," Hal said, trying not to sound impatient. "But time is short, and I want to go home," she thought, but did not say. There was a silence. The wind howled in the struts of the pier, and in the distance Hal could hear the crash of the breakers.
"I got a choice," the woman said eventually, her voice grudging as if the words were wrung out of her.
She shifted in her seat, making the candle flame gutter. "Yes," Hal said carefully. not quite a question. I sense that you have two roads ahead of you, but they twist and turn, and you can't see far. You want to know which you should take.
In other words, a choice. It was pretty pitiful stuff, as well it might be given how little she had to work on, but the woman gave a grudging nod.
I will shuffle the cards, Hal said.
She opened the lacquered box where she kept her work cards and shuffled them briefly, then spread them out on the table in a long arc.
Now, hold the question you came to consult me about in your mind, and indicate a card to me. Don't touch, just point with your finger to the card that calls to you.
The woman's jaw was clamped, and Hal sensed a turmoil in her out of all proportion. Whatever had driven her here tonight was no ordinary question. She had come against her will, turning to something she believed in spite of herself. When she leaned forward, a cross glinted out from behind her buttoned-up cardigan, and she gestured jerkily at a card, almost as if she suspected a trap.
This one? Hal said, pushing it out from the deck, and the woman nodded.
Hal placed it face down in the centre of the table and glanced discreetly at the clock positioned behind the woman's back. Usually she did the Celtic cross, but she was damned if she'd spend half an hour with this woman when she was tired and cold and her stomach was rumbling. A three-card spread was the very most she was going to do.
This card, Hal touched the card the woman had chosen, represents the current situation, the problem you have come to consult me about. Now choose another.
The woman flicked her finger towards a second card, and Hal placed it alongside the first, face down again.
This card represents the obstacle you face. Now choose one final card.
The woman hesitated, and then pointed at the first card in the deck to the far left of the spread. It was one people rarely chose. Generally, people picked towards the middle in a fairly even spread, choosing the cards closest to them, or a very few, the most suggestible types, picked up on the implicit instruction in final and chose a card towards the right of the spread at the bottom of the original pack. To pick the first card was unusual, and Hal was surprised.
She should have known, she thought.
This was someone perverse and contrary, someone who would do the opposite of what they thought you wanted.
This final card represents the advice the cards are giving you, Hal said.
She turned the first card, and from the other side of the table she heard a choking sound, as the woman's hand went to her face to cover her mouth and smother a name. Looking up, Hal saw that the woman's eyes were wide and harrowed and full of tears. And suddenly she knew. She knew why the woman was here, and she knew what the image on the card meant to the woman sitting opposite. The young man setting out with his pack into the sunshine was handsome and smiling, turning his dark face to the sun, and only the cliff edge at his feet gave a clue to the deeper, darker meanings of the card. Impetuosity, naivety, impulse.
This card is called the Fool, Hal said softly, and when the woman gave a little broken sob and a nod, almost in spite of herself, she went on, but tarot isn't about simple meanings. The Fool, though he can symbolize foolishness, doesn't always mean that. Sometimes this card means new beginnings. Sometimes it means doing things without thinking about the path ahead, without considering the future.
The woman gave another dry, choking sob and said something that sounded like his future,
in a tone of such bitter disbelief that Hal could not help herself. She put out her hand. Forgive me, but is your question about your son?
The woman began to cry at that, broken and in earnest. And as she wept, she nodded, and Hal heard words tumbling out. Names of drugs, of treatment centres she recognised in Brighton, needle exchanges, of money stolen from handbags, of treasured heirlooms sold and pawned, of sleepless nights waiting for a call that didn't come. The story between the racking sobs was plain enough. A desperate struggle to save a son who did not want to be saved. A choice, the woman had said. And Hal knew what that choice was. And she wished now that she had not opened the door. With a feeling of foreboding, Hal turned the second card. It was the wheel, reversed. The second card you chose represents the obstacle you and your son face together. This is the Wheel of Fortune, or the Wheel of Life. It symbolizes fortune and renewal and the cycle of life, and shows that you and your son have come to a turning point. A little reluctant nod as the woman swiped fiercely at her eyes. But here it's reversed. That's what we call it when the card is upside down like this. The wheel reversed represents bad luck. This is the obstacle that has come into your life. There are negative forces here that are out of your control, but they are not always completely external. They come about as the result of choices we've made in the past. Your choices and your son's, of course.
His choices, the woman said bitterly. His choices, not mine. He was a good boy until he took up with those boys at his school and started dealing. What was I supposed to do, stand by and watch him sink into depravity?
Her eyes were bleak holes in her skull. And as she waited for Hal's response, she bit at the chapped skin of her lips, pulling at it with her teeth until a bead of blood appeared. Hal shook her head. Suddenly, she wanted this to be over very much indeed. The last card represents a possible course of action, but the hunger in the woman's eyes made her add hastily, "It's important to know that it is not a prescription. The cards don't predict the future. They don't give a fail-safe course. They simply tell you what could, on a given day, be one outcome to your problem. Some situations have no simple resolution. All we can do is steer the course that causes the least harm." She turned the card, and the High Priestess turned her serene face up to the dim, flickering light. From outside there was a gust of wind, and in the distance Hal heard a seagull's scream.
"What does it mean?"
the woman demanded, all her scepticism gone, subsumed by desperation for answers. She stared down at the figure on the card, seated on her throne, her hands spread like a benediction.
"Who is she? Some kind of heathen goddess?"
"In a way," Hal said slowly. "Some call her Persephone. Some say she is Artemis, goddess of the hunt. Some call her even older names. In French she's called La Papesse."
"But what does she mean?"
the woman said again, more urgently. Her fingers closed like claws on Hal's wrist, painfully tight, and Hal had to fight the urge to pull away. "She means intuition," Hal said shortly. She disengaged herself from the woman's grip under pretense of rearranging the cards into a single pile, the priestess on top. "She symbolizes the unknown, both the unknown within ourselves and the future. She means that life is changing, that the future is always uncertain, no matter how much information we can gather."
"So what should I do?" the woman cried. "I can't go through this over and over, but if I throw him out, what kind of mother does that make me?"
I believe.
Hal swallowed and then stopped.
She hated this part, hated the way they came to her, asking for answers she couldn't give.
She thought carefully and then began again.
Look, this is a very unusual spread.
She turned the rest of the pack over and spread them out, showing the woman the ratio of major to minor cards. The fact that the vast majority of the pack were numbered pip cards.
These cards, these numbered ones with the suits on them, these are what we call minor cards. They have their own meanings, of course, but they are more mutable, perhaps, more open to interpretation. But these others...
She touched the cards the woman had chosen, and the rest of the trumps dotted through the spread.
These symbolic cards are called the major arcana, or trumps. To have a spread that's completely composed of trump cards, as you had, that's statistically very unusual. There just aren't that many of these cards in the deck. And the point is that, in tarot, these cards represent the strong winds of fate, the turning points in our lives, and when you get a large number of these cards in a reading, it can mean that the situation is largely out of your hands, that it will play out as the fates intend.
The woman said nothing. She only looked at Hal, her eyes so hungry they made Hal almost afraid. Her face in the candlelight was shadowed, the eye sockets sunken.
Ultimately, Hal said softly, you have to decide for yourself what the cards are telling you,
but my feeling is that the priestess is telling you to listen to your intuition. You know the answer already. It's there in your heart.
The woman drew back from Hal, and then she nodded very slowly and bit her white, chapped lips.
Then she stood, threw down a crumple of notes on the table, and turned on her heel. The kiosk door banged behind her, letting in a gust of wind, and Hal snatched for the notes, spreading them out, and then shook her head when she saw how much had been left.
Wait! She called.
She ran to the door, forcing it open against the thrust of the wind. It caught from her fingers and slammed back against the side of the kiosk, making her wince for the fragile Victorian glass. But she could not spare more than a glance back to check it was okay. The woman was already disappearing. She began to run, her feet slipping on the wet planks.
Wait!
The wind had picked up, and a mix of rain and salt spray stung her eyes as she reached the entrance to the pier, the illuminated sign above the entrance casting long, flickering shadows.
Wait, come back!
She called into the wet night, straining through the drizzle for a shadowy figure.
This is far too much!
She was panting, but now she tried to still her breath, listening for the sound of footsteps hurrying through the darkness. But she could hear nothing above the roar of the sea and the patter of the rain. The promenade was empty, and the woman had disappeared into the darkness, as if made from rain herself. Hal was wet and shivering by the time she gave up. The notes still crumpled in her hand, fast softening in the rain that dripped from the canopy. £60 the woman had left, a ridiculous sum, more than four times Hal's usual charge for a 15-minute reading. And for what? For making a few simple guesses and telling her to listen to what she already knew? Shaking her head, she pushed the notes into her pocket with a shiver and turned round, ready to go back to her booth, close up for the night. As she passed beneath the covered entrance, she put her hand down automatically to pat the plastic guide dog with the slot in his head for charitable donations, as hundreds of children did every time they passed him. Hal had always patted him as a little girl, every time she visited her mother, and sometimes, if they had had a bit of money to spare, her mother had let her put a pound in the slot at the top. It was a custom she tried to keep up, though lately the pounds had dwindled to 50-pence pieces, and sometimes to pennies. Tonight, with those two anonymous letters fresh in her mind, she hadn't been intending to give anything at all. But now, as she passed through the high, arched gate, she hesitated and turned back. The dog sat patiently beneath the inadequate shelter of the canopy, along with two other donation boxes, though the others were less popular with children. One was a ship in a frame for the Royal National Lifeboat Institute, and the other was a giant ice cream cone with a sign saying, "Support the West Pier's chosen charity. This month we are donating to..." and a space to advertise the current good cause. Now, Hal bent to look at the wet paper slip that had been inserted. It was hard to read the letters, for rain or seawater had got in behind the plastic and made the ink run, but Hal could just make out the words. The Lighthouse Project, Drug Rehabilitation in Brighton and Hove. Hal felt in her pocket for the fistful of wet notes the woman had left, and she thought of the pile of red demands on the coffee table, and the note slid beneath the kiosk door. Her hand shook as she counted out the banknotes, and then, one by one, she shoved them into the slot of the ice cream cone, trying not to think of the shoes they could have bought, the bills she could have paid, and the hot dinners she could have eaten with the money. At last, the final note fluttered through the slot, and as she turned for home, the cone lit up, its bright pastel glow throwing a long shadow into the rainy night as she walked away. Chapter 7. Hal shivered as she made her way back to her kiosk. She wished she had brought her coat in the headlong rush to catch up with the woman. Now she was wet through, and she would have to walk home in cold, wet clothes and waste more money on gas to try to warm up before bed. She picked her way carefully, avoiding the broken planks, feeling the rain-wet wood slippery beneath her feet, the puddles glittering in the few lights still showing. It wasn't yet 10 p.m, but the pier was almost closed. The ballroom was locked, Reg's tea kiosk was shuttered, and the candy floss stand had the blinds pulled down inside. "No cash left on these premises," read the sign, and though if Hal hadn't seen it 100 times before, she would have had a hard time making out the words, with the strings of light swinging in the gusting wind and casting crazy lurching shadows over everything. The pier didn't shut for the winter. It had once, but now it was a year-round operation, like its twin sister further up the beach. But there was a definite air of winding down at the end of the season, and Hal sighed as she thought of the long winter days that lay ahead. Now, though, she wondered, could she afford to keep going? But if she didn't, what was the alternative? When she got back to the kiosk, the door was closed, though she had no memory of shutting it. She put her hand to the salt-rusted knob and turned the door handle and slipped inside the dark booth, feeling the relief as the wind dropped and the vestigial warmth from the space heater enveloped her.
"Hello, sunshine," said a voice, and the red shaded lamp on the table clicked on. Hal felt the blood drain from her face, and her heart start beating in her ears with a sound like the crash of waves on a beach. The man standing in the pool of lamplight was very tall and very broad and very bald, and he was smiling, but not in a pleasant way. He was smiling like someone who enjoyed scaring people. And Hal was scared. "Well," she tried, but her voice didn't seem to be working. "What are you doing here?" "Maybe I've come for a reading," the man said pleasantly, but he had his hand in his coat pocket, caressing something in there in a way Hal didn't like. He spoke with a slight lisp, his speech whistling through a gap in his two front teeth. "I'm closed," she managed to say, trying to keep her voice steady.
"Oh, don't be like that,"
the man said reproachfully.
"You could manage a reading for an old friend of your ma's now, couldn't you?"
Hal felt something inside her grow cold and still. "What do you know about my mother?"
"I've been asking around about you, friendly curiosity-like."
"I'd like you to leave," Hal said. There was a panic button in her booth, but it was on the far side where the man himself was standing, and in any case, it would all depend on whether the peer security guard was in his office. The man shook his head, and she felt the panic rise up in her, choking her.
"I said, get out!"
"Tut, tut,"
said the man, shaking his head, the smile slipping for a moment, though it was still there, in his eyes, a kind of amusement at the terror he saw in her and at the way she was trying to hide it. The lamplight glinted off his bald head.
"What would your ma say to her little girl? Treating an old friend of hers like that?"
"I'm not a little girl," Hal said through gritted teeth. She wrapped her arms around herself, trying to stop her hands shaking. "And I don't believe for a second you knew my mother. What do you want?"
"I think you know what we want. You can't say we didn't try to do this the nice way. Mr. Smith wrote you that note himself, he did. He wouldn't do that for all his clients."
"What do you want?" Hal repeated stonily. But it wasn't really a question. She knew, just as she knew what the note meant. The man shook his head again.
"Come on now, Miss Westaway. Let's not play games. It's not like you didn't know the terms when you signed up."
"I've paid off that money 3-4 times over," Hal said. She heard an edge of desperation creeping into her voice. "For God's sake, please, you know I have. I must have given you more than £2,000. I only borrowed £500 in the first place."
"Terms is terms. You agreed the interest. If you didn't like it, you shouldn't have agreed to it."
"I had no other choice." But the man only smiled again and shook his head.
"Naughty, naughty. We always have choices, Miss Westaway. You chose to borrow money off Mr. Smith, and he wants it back. Now, he's not an unreasonable man. Your debt is currently at..."
He pretended to consult a piece of paper he held in his hand, though Hal was pretty sure it was all for show.
£3,825. But Mr. Smith has kindly offered to take 3,000 cash as a final payment, and we'll call it settled."
"I haven't got £3,000, Hal said. She felt her voice rising and swallowed, forcing herself to lower it from a shout to a more reasonable level.
"Slow down."
It was her mother's voice in her head, soft and calming. Hal remembered her telling her about how to deal with difficult clients.
"Make them realize you're in control, not them. Don't let them make all the demands. Remember, you're in charge of this reading. You ask the questions. You set the pace."
If only this was a reading. If only she had this man across a table with the cards in between them. But she didn't. She would just have to work with the situation she was in. She could do this. "Look," she said more reasonably. She drew a shaky breath,
made herself unfold her arms from their defensive posture, spread her hands to show honesty. She even forced herself to smile, though it felt like a rictus grin.
"Look, I want this settled as much as you do, more, actually. But I haven't got 3,000, or any way of getting it. You might as well ask for the moon. So, let's try to work out what I can offer that your boss will find acceptable. £50 a week?"
She didn't stop to think about how she would come up with the money. £50 a week was money she just didn't have at this time of year. But maybe Mr. Calm would let her defer the rent by a month, and Christmas often meant a small surge in business with work parties and late-night shopping. Regardless, she would find the money.
"Here."
She went to the table, picked up the latched box that she kept on the side with the day's takings. Her hands were shaking almost too much to work the lock, but at last she got it open, and when she held out the notes, she made herself look up at him through her lashes and smile. A little girl's smile, shy and pleading, appealing to his better nature, if he had one.
"Look, there's 20, 30, nearly £40 here. Take that to be going on with."
Never mind that she still needed to pay Chalky White for the lease on the kiosk. Never mind the bills and the rent and the fact that she had no food in the house. Anything to get him out of her kiosk and buy her some time. But the man was shaking his head.
"Look, you gotta understand. If it were up to me, I'd love to. There's nothing I'd like better than to help out a young girl like you, all alone in the world."
His eye swept appraisingly round the little kiosk.
"But it isn't up to me. And Mr. Smith, he feels like he's been very generous, and you've taken advantage of that generosity. Mr. Smith wants his money. End of."
"Or what?" Hal said, suddenly weary of it all. She shoved the notes in her pocket, and deep within her, in the core of her, she felt a flicker of anger ignite, its determined warmth beginning to replace her chilly fear. "What's he going to do? Seize my goods? I've got nothing to offer you. You could sell everything I own and it wouldn't raise 3 grand. Take me to court? I didn't sign anything. You've got nothing except your word against mine. Or maybe he'll go to the police. You know..." She paused, as if the idea had only just struck her.
"Yes! That's an idea. Maybe we should do that. I think they'd be interested in his loan collection methods."
That wiped the smile off the man's face, and he leaned forward so close to Hal's face that she could feel his saliva flecking her forehead as he spat the words. She forced herself not to flinch away.
"Now that, Miss Westaway, is a very, very stupid suggestion. Mr. Smith has a lot of friends in the police, and I think they'd be upset to hear you talking like that about one of their mates. You say you didn't sign anything? Well, guess what that means, Miss Clever Clogs? No bloody evidence. You've got nothing to take to the police except for your word against mine. I'm going to give you 1 week to raise that money. And I don't want to hear any fucking nonsense about not having any way of getting it. You sell something, you rob someone, you stand on a street corner and give randy businessmen blowjobs in the back seat of their car for 20 quid a pop. I don't fucking care. I want that money by this time next week. You reckon you've got nothing now? You can have a lot less than this, sweetheart. A lot Leth.
With that, he turned and, very casually, swept everything off the shelf behind the table. Hal flinched as the contents went crashing down. The crystal ball on its wooden stand, the carved, painted ornaments, the clay pot she had made her mother for some long-ago Christmas present, the books and cups, and the china vase of cow chim sticks. Down they came, smashing one by one across the desk and floor below. "Oops!" The man deadpanned, the lisp of the S somehow making the word sound even more sarcastic. He turned and gave her a wide, gap-toothed smile.
"Sorry about that. I'm a bit clumsy, me. Broken bones, too. Lots of bones. Knocked out 3 teeth the other day. Accidentally. But accidents happen, don't they?"
Hal found she was trembling. She wanted to run away from the booth, hammer on the door of the security guard's office, crouch under the dripping boardwalk of the pier until he went, but she could not, would not, give way. She would not show him her fear.
"I'll be off now," he said.
He pushed past her to the door, and as he did, he put out one hand and casually tipped the table, sending the tarot cards flying into the air, and Hal's cup of tea, left over from the morning, smashing to the floor. The cold tea spattered Hal's face, making her flinch. In the doorway, he paused, turned up his collar against the rain.
"Goodbye, Miss Westaway."
That sibilant whistling S.
"See you next week."
And then he was gone, slamming the door behind him. Hal stood for a long moment, frozen, listening to his steps disappearing up the pier. And then something inside her seemed to release, and with shaking hands she pulled the latch of the kiosk door shut and then stood, her back to the door, trembling with relief and fear. It had been almost a year ago that she had taken out the loan, and now she couldn't believe she had been so stupid. But at the time she had felt backed into an impossible corner. It had been winter, takings from the pier had fallen and fallen, until one awful week she had made only £70. The other stallholders had shrugged and told her some weeks were just like that, inexplicably bad. But for Hal, it had been a disaster. She had no savings to fall back on, no second job. She was behind on the rent, behind on the bills. She had no way of covering the lease on the kiosk, even. She had tried everything. She'd advertised for a roommate, but no one wanted a flat where the landlady slept on a sofa in the one room. She'd attempted to find bar work, but it clashed with the time she was supposed to be at the pier, and in any case, one look at her empty CV and most of the places she'd tried had simply shaken their heads. Even the job centre had sucked their teeth when she told them she'd never even finished her A-levels. The fact that her mother had died 2 weeks before she had been supposed to take the exams didn't really matter. "Touch up a relative," one of the guys on the pier had said. "Call in a favour from a mate." And Hal had not known how to reply, not known how to explain quite how alone in the world she was. Yes, she had grown up in Brighton, had even had friends here before her mother's death, but it was hard to explain how frighteningly fast their lives had diverged after the accident. She remembered turning up to college the day after the funeral, listening to them laughing about mobile phone bills, boyfriends, being grounded for some minor misdemeanor, and feeling like she was in a separate world. The image that had kept coming to her at the time was of a railway track, with the route stretching out ahead of her pre-planned. A-levels, university, internships, careers. And then a switch had been thrown, and she had been hurled down a completely different route, simply trying to survive, to pay the bills, to get by from day to day while her friends continued on down the old familiar track that Hal herself should have taken, if not for that speeding car. There had been no time for A-levels. She had dropped out of college, taken over the kiosk, and coped in any way that she could. One moment trying to forget, cropping her hair so that she didn't see her mother's face in the mirror quite so painfully every day. Drinking herself into oblivion when she could afford the alcohol. The next moment holding on to her memories with painful intensity, inking them into her skin. The person she was now was not the girl she would have been. The girl who had given her pocket money to the homeless, frittered away pennies on the pier, whiled away Sundays eating popcorn in front of bad films. She was gone. In her place was someone hardened. Someone who had had to become hardened in order to survive. The laughing confidence of that girl on the beach had been stripped away, but inside, she had found a very different kind of strength that she had barely even known was there. A cold, hard core of determination that made her get up on frosty mornings to walk to the pier, even when her nose streamed with cold and her eyes were red with weeping. A kind of steel that made her carry on, putting one foot in front of another, even when she was too tired to keep going. She had become a different person. The person she was now walked past beggars and turned her face away. The TV had been sold, and she never had Sundays off anyway. She was always tired from working and always hungry, and most of all, she was lonely. A few months after the funeral, she had seen a group of her old friends in Brighton Town Centre, and they had not even recognised Hal. They had walked straight past her, talking and laughing. For a moment, she had turned and opened her mouth, ready to call after them, but then she had stopped. A chasm had opened up between them, and it was too wide for any of them to bridge. They would not have understood anything about the person she had become. So she had watched them walk away without saying a word, and then, just weeks later, they had scattered to universities all around the country, to jobs and careers and gap years, and now she didn't see them anymore, even from afar. But she did not know how to explain all that to the pier worker. No, was all she had said, her throat tight with loss and anger at his casual belief that everyone must have someone to fall back on. No, I can't do that. She couldn't quite remember how the suggestion had come about. But at last she had become aware of someone who did loans, no collateral needed. The interest was high, but the lender would accept small repayments, even let you skip a week if you couldn't keep up. It was all unofficial, no office premises, meetings in odd places, envelopes of cash. But it seemed like the answer to a prayer, and Hal jumped at it. It wasn't until a few months in that she had the wit to ask how far she was getting in paying back her debt. The answer had made her rock back on her heels. £500 she had borrowed. She'd actually only asked for £300, but the man had been nice enough to suggest that she upped it a little to see her through any rough patches. She'd been paying it back at the rate of a few pounds a week for about 4 months. And now, the debt was over 1,000. Hal had panicked. She had paid back the unspent part of the original loan and upped the repayments to the maximum she could afford, but she'd been too optimistic. She couldn't keep up with the new schedule, and after one particularly bad week at the pier, she missed a payment, and then a month later she missed another. As the repayments spiralled and the calls from Mr. Smith's collectors got more and more aggressive, Hal realised the truth. She had no way out. Eventually, she did the only thing she could do. She simply stopped paying. She stopped answering calls from unregistered numbers. She stopped answering the door. And she started looking behind her when she walked home alone at night. The one saving grace, she had kept telling herself, was they didn't know where she worked. On the pier, she was safe, and up until now, she had at least felt secure in the knowledge that there was a limit to what they could do. She had no goods for them to seize, and she was fairly sure that the arrangement itself was on the shady side of legal. They were highly unlikely to take her to court. But now it seemed that they had tracked her down, and their patience had run out. As Hal's shivering subsided, the words the man had uttered seemed to echo inside her head. Broken bones. Broken teeth. Hal had never thought of herself as cowardly or vain. But at the thought of that steel toe-capped boot casually swinging towards her face, the crunch as it met her nose and teeth, she couldn't help flinching. So what could she do? Borrowing money was out of the question. There was no one she could ask, no one who had that kind of funds at their disposal anyway. And as for turning tricks on the street corner as the man had suggested, Hal felt her mouth twist in grim revulsion. Brighton had a thriving sex trade, but she wasn't that desperate. Not yet. Which left stealing. You have two roads ahead of you, but they twist and turn. You want to know which one to take. Back at the flat, Hal let herself in the front door and stood silently in the hallway listening. No sound came from above, and when she reached the topmost landing, the door to her flat was closed, no light showing beneath it. As she looked closer at the door lock, though, she thought there was something different about the scratches on the plate, as if someone had been at work with a picklock. Or was that just her own paranoia? Surely all lock plates had chips and scrapes on them from keys carelessly shoved in, clattering against the metal. Her heart was beating fast as she inserted her key, unsure of what she might find on the other side. But as the door swung wide and she groped for the light, her first thought was that everything was miraculously untouched. There was the post where she had left it on the table. There was her laptop, nothing broken, nothing stolen for part payment. Hal's heart slowed, and she let out a sigh, not quite of relief, but of something close to it, as she shut the door behind her and double-locked it, then shrugged off her jacket. But it was only when she went across to the kitchen counter to turn on the kettle that she noticed two things. The first was a pile of ashes in the sink, ashes that had definitely not been there when she left. It looked as if a sheet of paper had been burned, perhaps two. Peering closer, Hal made out letters on one of the scraps that had not yet crumbled to fragments, silvery against the black background. "Refino," she made out, and beneath it, "All again." Hal knew what it was. even without glancing behind herself at the coffee table where she had left the letters from Mr. Smith, neatly stacked beside the bills. She knew they would be gone, even before she looked round. But still she could not stop herself from checking, from moving the pile of final demands aside, searching desperately in case they had gusted off the table when she opened the door. It was no use. The letters were gone, and with them any evidence she could have shown to the police. And something else was missing too, she realized with a lurch. The photograph on the mantelpiece. The picture of Hal and her mother, arm in arm on Brighton Beach, their hair gusting in the sea wind. As she stepped towards the shelf where it should have been, something crunched beneath her boots, and when she looked down, there it was, the frame face up on the hearth, the glass smashed to smithereens by a stamped foot, the picture scratched and torn by the grinding of a heel into the broken frame. Her hands shaking, eyes swimming, Hal forced herself to pick it up, cradling it like some small, broken animal picking out the shards of glass from the paper. But it was no good. The picture was ripped and ruined, and the laughing faces of that girl and her mother were gone for good. She would not cry. She refused to. But she felt something huge and bitter and wild with grief rise up inside her. It was the injustice of it that stung so, like acid in her throat. She wanted to cry out with it, scream with the unfairness of it all. I want to break, she wanted to sob. Just once. I want something to go my way. She found herself sinking to her knees, bowed down beneath the weight of it all. And for a moment, she crouched over the broken shards of glass, her head bent, hugging her knees to her ribcage, as if to make herself as small and safe as possible. But there was no safety anymore. No one to hug her and clean up the mess and make her a hot cup of tea. She was going to have to deal with this herself. As she began to pick up the glass, sweeping the splinters carefully with the sleeve of her coat, Reg's voice sounded in her head, his comforting cockney croak.
If anyone deserves a break, it's you, my darling. You take any money they offer you and run. That's my advice. Take the money and run.
If only she could.
She slipped the glass into the bin, the torn scraps of photograph fluttering after.
You have two roads ahead of you, but they twist and turn. You want to know which you should take. Hal's phone was in her pocket, and, almost without being aware of what she was doing, she pulled it out and opened up the Trainline website. 1st of December, 7 a.m, Brighton to Penzance return. She clicked. If anyone can pull this off, it's you.
When the ticket prices came up on screen, she couldn't suppress a wince. The money in her pocket wasn't enough to cover the fare, not even a single, and her overdraft was already maxed out.
But maybe, if the website didn't check in with her bank.
She pulled out her bank card, tapped in the number and held her breath.
Miraculously, the payment went through.
Even so, Hal didn't quite believe it until her phone vibrated with an email.
Here's everything you need for your Penzance trip, it read. And below that, a ticket collection number confirming her purchase. Her stomach clenched and turned as if she were riding a ship in rough seas and a wave had dropped away beneath the hull. Was she really going to do this? But what was the alternative?
Wait here for Mr. Smith's minions to pay her a return visit.
I might be heir to a secret fortune. The words she had spoken to Reg echoed in her ear, half taunt, half promise. Hal stood, feeling the stiffness in her limbs, the tiredness of her muscles now that the adrenalized fear had abated. It might be true. And if it wasn't, perhaps she could make it true. All she had to do was make herself believe it.
When she headed to her bedroom, she told herself it was to go straight to bed. But instead, she pulled her mother's battered suitcase from the top of the wardrobe and began to pack. Shampoo, deodorant, that was straightforward. What to wear was more difficult. Black was not a problem. More than half Hal's wardrobe was black or grey. But she couldn't turn up to a stranger.